Rick Mahn is locked and loaded on today's News Talk Radio, TNT. Whew.
Wow, wow, wow. What a day we have had on Locked and Loaded. Been talking to a guy from England. Yeah. Dr. Kevin Corbett, nonetheless. We were getting very worked up, let's just say, about demonization of certain groups of the British public in relation to the push for the monkeypox vaccine campaign that they're really pushing and starting to seed into the public's mind. People have said, oh, they're trying this and it doesn't seem to be working. It's not catching on. What are they going to do about it? Listen, they haven't even started yet. They really will pull out all the stops to get another thing into people's minds and another excuse to lock people down and another excuse to demonize certain groups and point the finger at them. This can all be found, by the way, on the UK government's own website. Yes, they make no bones about it under monkeypox vaccines. Go have a read at it and tell me if it doesn't echo the 1980s HIV AIDS campaign and further back if you want to hop across to Germany in the 1930s. Yes, I would not put anything past our government right now. Oh, I need to take some deep breaths. You know, after the last guest, I went out, I got a sip of water, I took a little bit of honey. Then I said hello to my daughter, who's just woken up, by the way, the lazy little thing, at 12 p.m. She's just finished school. She has her summer holidays. And we got into a conversation. I went, hell, I got to go. I got to get back online. I'm in the middle of a show here. So I'm a little bit flabbergasted, so bear with me here. My next guest is waiting in the wings, waiting to pounce. Yes, but before I usher him to take the stand, to take the witness stand, let's look at what's going on in the news. This is good. Police fail to solve a single burglary in nearly half of the country. An old age pensioner has said in the Daily Telegraph, it is a violation, a horrible thing to happen, but I have got no sympathy from the police and they haven't solved my crime. So basically, in the last 3 years, half of the areas in which burglaries have been reported in the UK have not led to a single conviction. If people were on the streets asking to be treated like free people and not othered and demonized for not being vaccinated, they would get a bop on the head with a truncheon. They would get jumped on by the goon squad. They would be handcuffed and flung headfirst into the back of a meat wagon. Not the case with burglars, I might say. You know, those guys that creep around and steal your TVs and your valuables? No. If you're a burglar, you're off scot-free in at least half of the country. So any burglars out there, you're in the right profession. The chances of you getting collared by the old bill are next to nothing. We've already touched on the possibility of a summer of strikes, and I'll be talking about that with my next guest. Bin men, teachers, barristers, postmen, rail workers, they're all going on strike. Maybe I should strike in the month of July. I need a break. I've told Mike Grant I want a week off. He said, okay, I'm going to strike. I'm going to say radio presenters need time off too. We want more money. He'll probably tell me to piss off, so I'm not going to try it with Mike Grant. Dominic Raab, we've looked at that guy. Chris Hutchinson from Melbourne has thanked the Qantas CEO, that's the Australian airline, Alan Joyce, for ensuring the safety of passengers on the 50-minute flight from Sydney to Melbourne was a priority by enforcing face masks. So we have some gimp coming on here thanking an airline for enforcing a mask mandate on a 50-minute internal flight. What happened to the men of this world? Too much decaf coffee, too much soya lattes, too much moisturizer. They pluck their eyebrows. They wear skinny jeans. They don't wear socks. Don't get me started. I'm as rough as a badger's ass, by the way. I look like a hobo. I can't really talk about personal grooming, but you know, something has been lost along the way. And by the way, you don't have to, some of the pretty boys out there, they can fight hard. I remember back in the day, an old friend of mine had long waist-length hair, and from the back, he looked like a girl. And we were coming out of a pub one night, and some dude came up behind him and thought it was a girl, and he grabbed him by the ass. And I'm not even going to tell you what happened. The guy had most of his teeth knocked out and his nose smashed. So be careful. Be careful who you judge, and don't judge by appearances. Whew. Listen, we're going to take a real short break, and we're going to be right back on TNT Radio.
engaged and informed conversation.
They say what I'm thinking.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Roger Tattersall, a.k.a. Rog Tall Bloke, is back. Back in TNT Towers. And you know what? He's so
morning,
tall.
Rick.
His head is almost actually off the top of the screen. He's 6'8" in his bare feet and 7'2"
I want you to read the t-shirt out, mate. That's why the head's off.
Reclaim Yorkshire. We got to give them a plug. You know, this guy is a faithful advocate for the Reclaim Party, and especially in his home county, beloved Yorkshire, God's own county. How's that for an intro? Do you like it?
It's a fantastic day today in Yorkshire, Rick. The sun is smiling, and I'm really glad to be back with you on the radio. Thanks for the intro. Looking forward to the hour's discussion. Let's go.
Yeah, as you can see, I'm a little bit bubbly, boisterous today. And you know what? I'm not even finishing. When my show finishes today, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to stay on, and the next guy that's coming online, I'm going to be his guest because I can't stop talking. So there you go. But I'm going to try and let you get some opinions and words in edgeways here today. Heavens above, where are we even going to start? I mean, you're a climate guy, you're a politics guy, you're an immigration guy, you're a decent guy. Where the hell are we going to start? There's so much to talk about. Where are we going to start?
Well, there's certainly plenty of material on offer, isn't there, Rick? You know, but I think firstly, we should start by extending our commiserations to people in the Near East, in Afghanistan, elsewhere, that have just been the victims of a huge earthquake. There's collapsed buildings. Oh. There's people trapped under rubble. It was announced in your top of the hour news, and so you know my heartfelt feelings and sympathies go out to everybody affected by that. I hope the emergency services can get in and help all those people soon. And it just shows the raw power of nature, the real force of environmental change. You know, these people have had their environment changed in the most destructive and shocking way today, and it just puts into perspective the very slow and gradual change of less than 1 degree centigrade that's occurred over 100 years that the UN wants us to all get in a flap about. When we have daily temperatures changing by many times that amount, and humans living quite well in temperatures ranging in the Arctic from sort of minus 20 right down to the equator, where it often gets up to 50. So you know, bit of perspective there, and my sympathies and heartfelt concern goes out to all those people.
Even, you know, as you say, an earthquake, bang, it happens. There might be a little bit of a tremor, then the thing hits. And sometimes it literally, in the space of 10, 20 seconds, it can just level an entire city or a village or an area, just like that. And this isn't something that takes 100 years to build up to. And people are scratching their heads going, is this real or is it not? Listen, if you're in an earthquake, you're going to know about it. For starters, you'll be terrified. Secondly, the buildings around you will be collapsing. And thirdly, probably people will be dying in numbers. That's real nature in force, rather than what we're being pushed upon, you know, to terrify us, climate terrorists. You know, people are out there trying to terrorize us into saying, if we don't do this and if we don't do that, it's game over. The water will be up to our ankles in a year, and in 2 years, it'll be up to our waist, and in 10 years, we'll be submerged. What a load of old bunkum that is. Hey?
Well, yeah, you know, and they tell us about wanting us to use less carbon-based fuels and so on. The truth of it is, Rick, is we are the carbon they're trying to reduce, that's what we've got to take cognizance of and start fighting back against, because there's some real seriously bad thinking and bad ideology out there that's arrayed against us, and we've got to get some common sense back into play.
Well, let me say this. I don't know if you've seen this one or not. This will make you chuckle, I'm sure. But the Daily Mail, God bless them, the Daily Mail are positioning us, are seeding into our heads that there could be four, they've numbered them, four heat waves in the UK this summer, with temperatures reaching at least 28 degrees Celsius.
Oh my goodness, so 28.
28 Celsius at a absolute minimum, it'll be 28 degrees Celsius. And brace yourselves for four, and check this one out. They want to start naming the heat waves like they name the hurricane. So Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane this, they want to call it like Heat Wave Roger, Heat Wave Rick, Heat Wave Reclaim, Heat Wave Linton. You know, that's what they want to do. Can you believe?
They'll probably call them Heat Wave Shell and Heat Wave Amoco, you know, and try and demonize the oil companies this way. You know, you can see it coming.
But can you believe that?
But it's 28 complete degrees. Nonsense, isn't it? Complete nonsense.
28 degrees.
As I say, you know, human beings are very adaptable. They live in extreme temperatures ranging from the very, very cold up near the pole to the very, very hot down at the equator and all points in between. And trying to start a panic over a 28 centigrade bit of nice summer warmth in the UK is just, let's deploy the word ludicrous.
It is ludicrous. And you see, actually, you use the extremes there. You've got the people up at the poles. You've got the people down in the equator. In Kenya, which is somewhere that I've spent a lot of time, by the way, all over the place, slap bang in the, well, it's not quite slap bang in the middle, but Kenya sits bang on the equator, okay? And Nairobi, which is the capital, is roughly in the middle, let's just say. So to the right, if you head towards the coast, you'll hit Mombasa. If you head up to the top left, you'll hit a place called Turkana Province, which borders in on southern Sudan and Ethiopia. Now, just within Kenya alone, the average temperature in Nairobi is a quite pleasant 20, 22 degrees Celsius. If you go down to Mombasa, it's a hellhole because it's the most humid place I've ever been to. It's about 30, 35 degrees. The humidity is about 99.9%, super uncomfortable. But if you head up to Turkana Province, all within the same country, it's approximately 40 degrees, 41 degrees, and no moisture at all. So this is all in the length and breadth of one country alone, let alone going from pole to pole and from equator to pole. Listen, it's always been like that. Turkana is not going to become a rain-swept, you know, oasis, and Mombasa is not going to become a nice temperate place where you go for an ice cream. You go there and sweat your ass off, whether you like it or not.
And in many parts of the world, Rick, you know, for many thousands of years, human beings have found excellent ways of dealing with this, not just dealing with it, but enjoying it. You know, so at some times of the year they'll be down on the coastal plains, you know, keeping warm where the warmth off the sea comes in the winter time, keeping the air warmer. Then in the summer they'll move up into the mountains, they'll move the animals up into the mountains to feed on the pastures that grow there in the summertime in great profusion. And you know, we live in an ample and abundant world, and we can live well in it. And we're being told all the time that the world's teetering on the brink of destruction, and that crops will fail, and that, you know, all this destruction will be brought about by us on ourselves. What a load of nonsense! You know, the fact of the matter is, human beings can do a great job of living on the earth. They can make more of an effort to look after endangered species. They can make more of an effort to keep the rivers clean, and we can deal with real pollution issues. And this is where the money should be going. It shouldn't be being wasted on crazy alternative energy schemes predicated on the idea that the stuff of life that plants use to grow with, carbon dioxide, is some kind of poisonous gas that we're going to kill the world with. It's crazy. Exactly. It's upside down. And we need to call it out at every opportunity.
And also, listen, we need to remember, we can simply adapt to adverse conditions as well. I'm using this Kenya thing as an example because I'm just a normal guy. I had to adapt depending on where I was. Otherwise, it would become very uncomfortable. So in Mombasa, what you do is you get up in the morning as early as possible, you head down to the coast itself, you sit on a wall somewhere, you let the sea breeze cool you down while you neck about 4 liters of water just to rehydrate yourself from all. It's not nice and it's not pleasant, but you adapt. If you go to Turkana province, on the other hand, okay, if you go to Turkana, on the other hand, all you want to do is find shade because there is no shade and the sun is beating down in your head at 40, 42 degrees Celsius and you will be cooked. And what I saw people doing was that the few trees that were there, depending on the way the shadow of the tree fell, you would have entire lines of people lying on the ground, head to toe, in the shadow of a skinny tree. And as the sun moved around, they shuffled around accordingly. It's not ideal. There was no canopies. There was nowhere else to take over. You adapt. So, you know, is this not another symptom of the... Yeah, like a human sun. That's exactly what it was like. So am I not right in saying, sort of linking back to an earlier statement that I made, are we becoming just too damn soft? And are people seeing that and saying, well, they can't hack it, they won't deal with it, so we will introduce measures to make their life more comfortable, and hence the buy-in to all these ludicrous green proposals and suggestions? Is that not part of the problem? We're just too wishy-washy.
Well, you know, the majority of human beings live in cities these days. You know, we've been moved off the country. They don't need so many people working in Western countries anyway. They don't need so many people working on the land because they've got a lot of automation, a lot of big machinery. Runs on oil. You're not going to be running a carbon, a huge combine harvester on lithium batteries anytime soon. I can assure you of that. And we live in cities in these kind of controlled environments. We have the central heating in the homes in winter. You know, we have air conditioning is in use a lot in the southern part of North America, for instance, in the USA, and people there are used to this very equitable, easy to live in, controlled environment, and so you can convince them that a 1 degree change is dangerous, I suppose. You know, but people who live out there, the vast majority in the third world and in countries that are less developed, they know how to deal with big swings in the annual cycle of temperatures, and the annual cycle of temperatures is order of magnitude bigger than any long-term change that they're trying to get us to be really scared of. So people just have to get a sense of perspective on this and realize that they're being sold a lie to put them under closer control. And we need to call it out because we're going to need more sensible energy policies very soon, which could segue us into a discussion about how sensible the sanctions that have been put on Russia are, given that the ruble's massively increased as a result of it, because we can't just stop buying their gas and oil in Europe. You know, otherwise everybody will freeze to death this winter.
Putin's done well out of this. Do you know what we'll do, actually, so we can stay in the flow? We're going to take a quick break. Believe it or not, we're up to the first break. We'll take a quick break for 2 minutes. When we come back, we'll pick up on this business. I also want to revisit a little place that's dear to your heart, a little place called Linton-on-Ouse, because that place just has not went away. And I've been talking about it nonstop since I last spoke to you, and it doesn't seem to be that problem is being dealt with or sorted out anytime soon. And you're a man on the ground in Yorkshire who's been there. There's a lot of skullduggery and shenanigans, as you well know, and I want to dig into Linton-on-Ouse and all other business when we come back after this short break on TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Mike Ryan.
Now, illegal avenues and effective means of pursuing government overreach during a pandemic, or probably, maybe it's a bit early to say. Well, one guy who knows all about this is Tony Nicholas. He's a freedom fighter of great strength and character. He's also a highly accomplished lawyer and criminologist committed to social justice. Has there been any court wins in relation to COVID-19 vaccine mandates in Australia?
At the present moment, there hasn't. There have been small inroads. So we've had a merits review that has been granted. Obviously, we've had small inroads in respect of how the courts may perceive these mandates with respect to the principle of legality. Okay, that's all about rights and whether someone can exercise their right to say no to something at the media. Now, the media has termed anyone that exercises a free will to be an anti-vaxxer.
Mike Ryan on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I think people should come to Freedom Fest for the friendship, getting to know folks, getting to talk with people that have similar views, but also can kind of challenge you a little bit.
One of the best things about Freedom Fest is coming here and learning that you are not alone in your fight for freedom.
There's people from all walks of life, from all across the United States and even the world come here.
Don't miss Freedom Fest,
the largest liberty event of the year.
July 13th to 16th at the Mirage in Las Vegas. For more information, go to freedomfest.com.
Show me. me the studies.
Today's News Talk Radio.
True study. This is safe for adults, much less kids.
TNT Radio. Live.
Okay. Yeah, Linton O'News, that's a place I've never been. I'm sure 99.9999.
Lovely, sleepy little village, Rick, at the moment.
I can picture, well, I can picture it, but I'm not picturing a lovely, sleepy little village. The last time you and I were talking, you brought this up, and I had seen it had made the headlines. And the reason why I'm bringing it up again is, I suppose, it's almost like it could be a case study for something that could go horribly wrong, which in this case could be the positioning of a large number of immigrants to a place that may just not be suitable for a large number of immigrants to be put into. Set aside the whole immigration debate. This is just simple logistics we're talking about. So in Yorkshire, there's a little place called Linton-on-Ouse, Linton-on-Ouse, unless I'm mistaken. And it's a village of about 600-700 people, quaint little English village. Everything's beautiful, little cottages, the village shop, the two old people, I believe, were trying to sell until dun, 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 they decided to ship 1,500, potentially 1,500 male immigrants to a disused RAF base up there, and yeah, to process them or maybe integrate them, I'm not sure. But effectively overnight, the village would have been outnumbered 2-1 by immigrants. Now, I understand one or two people coming into rural areas, but 2-1, 1,500 people at one time, surely that's not doable, is it? Is it? What's going on up there? Give us the report.
Well, we've been keeping a close eye on Linton. We've been to visit. We've had, you know, our leadership people up from London to come and visit with me. And we've talked to local people. We've conducted some interviews, which will be going out in a documentary that we're making. And it's just amazing that something like this could just be imposed on a group of people who live a kind of rural life. That RAF base has been there for many, many years. It was only decommissioned a couple of years ago. But having sort of RAF officers on your doorstep is a very different proposition to having people who discarded their identity and phones and so on as they came over the channel. We don't know who they are, what their background is. It's causing a lot of consternation because it's a village of 700 people. 100 of those people are very young. They're youngsters. And so, of course, parents naturally are concerned about the youngsters. They're concerned about teenagers and what could potentially go wrong. And it's absolutely natural that they should have those concerns. It's a completely natural thing for parents to worry and care about the safety and well-being of their kids. And yet, these people are being sidelined, shut down, told that they think wrongly, that they might be racist. That's being used to shut them up. They're being excluded from the online discussion group, which is supposed to be representing the locals. And this is, you know, a really, really bad situation where it's causing division, anger, animosity in a local community, with this thing being imposed on them with no proper planning permission, no advance warning, no prior discussion or consultation. And that's the thing that really angers the locals, is that government feels that it can just ride in there with no consultation and say, this is going to happen, deal with it. And so, you know, we're very concerned about free speech in the Reclaim Party. We want to give people a voice, especially when they've been deliberately excluded from community processes and local, what should be local democratic processes that enable a fair and balanced view to be taken on things. So we're engaged with that. We're keeping an eye on it. There seems to be a delay. A 2-month delay they're talking about, but still no guarantees. Some big lorries rolled in there a week ago. We found out that was to remove redundant aero parts from one of the big hangars. So maybe they're making space in that hangar because they need to use it as a staging area for bringing in all the new equipment and stuff they need to set the base up as this reception center for these illegal migrants and other migrants who are going to be moved there if they get their way. But there's going to be a lot of opposition to it, and a lot of bad feeling, and it's not a good situation.
Well, you told me, just going by memory here, because it really stuck in my head, you know, there was people who, before all this happened, you know, they wanted to move out of the village. They put the properties up for sale. You mentioned an old couple who ran the local shops. They only shop in the place. They've got health issues, I think. They're elderly. Yeah. They wanted to sell up shop before any of this happened, and they were in the process of doing that. But then this bombshell hit, and all of a sudden, no one wants to buy a property there. And one thing very important that you mentioned there, you know, because the easiest thing to do is to play the race card. Okay, you're racist. You don't want these people in because they're not white or whatnot. Listen, let me give you the example back with me being back in Kenya. And I went there to and fro for 12 years, most 20 odd times. I spent most of my times in rural villages. When I landed out alone in a rural village, I was treated with the utmost suspicion. Understandably,
yeah,
who is this guy? Where's he from? What does he want here? He doesn't speak the language, you know, and so on and so forth. I didn't feel like I was being prejudiced against because of the color of my skin. I would have acted the same way if a strange body had floated into my inner circle and was around my children. You want to make sure people are legit and they're not there for the wrong reasons. That's one person. Multiply that by 1,500, this is nothing to do with race. This is to do with people having legitimate concerns over their personal safety and the safety of their children and the integrity of the life that they have always lived in that little quaint corner of, Yorkshire. Is that being racist or is that being sensible?
That's right. It's nothing to do with race. It's everything to do with them being an unknown quantity, and the plan is that there will be a constant turnover of new unknown quantities arriving constantly as this reception centre, you know, turns over this population and people get their cases decided for asylum or, you know, for or against, and are then moved elsewhere. More new unknown quantities will be arriving all the time. Mm-hmm. So this will be a population in flux. They have nothing really to do around the village. They're not allowed to work for a living. They only get an allowance of £8 a week, which isn't going to go very far. You know, buying coffees in York, where they might get an opportunity to get onto a bus to go and visit once a week. They're going to be frustrated. All those young men. We all know, you know, that young men have needs and wants and desires, and this could lead to tragedies of various kinds, and that's what people are in fear of, and it's totally understandable fear, just as those people in the country that you went to didn't know how to regard you when you first arrived. They want to check you out. They want to see whether you're somebody they can make friends with.
Correct. And the thing is, too, you mentioned, you know, I'm highlighting points that you're making to counteract any possible accusations of racism. You said yourself, young men, you know, are young men. It doesn't matter if they're black, white, brown, blue, or green. They all have, you know, urges and ways of acting and testosterone and aggression levels and one thing and another. And let me put it this way. If 1,500 guys from Belfast landed on Linton & News, and you were told, listen, we can't tell you who these people are. We can't tell you anything about their backgrounds. You know, they're white like you. Don't worry about it. You'd still be upset and you'd still be suspicious and you'd still be concerned as hell. Say, well, who are these people? And where is the 1,500 of them coming into this village of old people? They're not going to work. They get £8 a day. There's young men there, young white men there.
Should we not be concerned?
Sorry, £8 a week. So, yeah, it's got nothing to do with skin color. It's got everything to do with, safety. Or am I misreading the situation completely?
You're absolutely on the mark, Rick. And so that is the really serious issue. And it is a serious issue because, you know, we see cases all around the country and they do occur. And there are issues and problems that we have to deal with. And so, you know, Linton, hopefully, in this 2 month temporary period where it's there's been a kind of a bit of a hold put on the execution of this Home Office plan. Hopefully, the Hambleton Council can get into gear with getting this judicial review. Hopefully, local people can sort themselves out to work together to oppose this in a strong and forceful way. You know, I mean, I know that in, you know, say in France, you know, the farmers would be blocking the roads with tractors to prevent any trucks arriving. They'd be dropping large trailer loads of manure on the Home Office doorsteps and doing, you know, being quite civilly disobedient. So, yeah, you know, the British people tend to be well behaved. They tend to be a bit shy and retiring. But I think that this one is really going to get people wound up.
I think it will. And I don't live in Yorkshire. I'm not a Yorkshireman, as you can probably tell by my accent. But, you know, I have been watching this closely and I have been, you know, perplexed by it. And it's almost like, you know, if you were, you know, you had your tinfoil hat on, you could say the government are doing this to wind people up. It's almost like I can see a powder keg forming here. And based on, you know, the reality of day-to-day life, there's no way that that will be implemented without a massive backlash from the public. There's just no way they will push that through. But if they persist on it, it will create a flashpoint, which is Linton on Ouse, which is somewhere that you would never have considered.
The government are just desperate for a solution. They've got all these full hotels. People can't fly abroad to go on holiday. There's a shortage of hotel places in our own country for people to take a break at because we're housing so many migrants at a cost of, you know, 5 million a day. The government is desperate to start finding an alternative solution to where these people can be accommodated while the process of their asylum applications goes through. And we could probably talk about the state of the asylum system and how much we're under the cosh of the European Court of Human Rights and whether Brexit should have led to a British Bill of Rights to replace that so that we could decide for ourselves in our own country how our borders are going to be managed and how these questions of how we deal with migrants can be managed. And so you've got to start dealing with the underlying cause as well as trying to find what sort of bandage you can put on the problem, you know, and deal with the symptom. You've got to look at the underlying causes and try and deal with those as well.
Do you know what we're going to do, right? I want to wrap this thing up about Linton. I want to take a break and then I want to look at this whole business because, you know, there were proposals put into place by good old Priti Patel. She wants to process certain asylum seekers in Rwanda. Flight was due to go there with 7 people on it at a cost of about 400k to the tax man or tax woman. And then the European Court of Human Rights blocked it. It's almost like they cut the you-know-whats off the British government and swung them in front of their faces and said, you're doing nothing of the sort. And we you know, bowed down and paid homage to the great gods of the European Court of Human Rights. But Linton, let's close this thing off in Linton for now, because it's something I want to keep under review with you. What is the resident level of concern is probably about 100%, but when it comes to the decision makers or the people that are pushing back at authority level, you know, you're always going to get virtue signalers here thinking, no, we must integrate and diversity is our strength, et cetera, et cetera. Let's give them a home, give them a Bible, blah, blah, blah. What is the percentage in virtue signaling versus actual genuine concern for people's lives?
Well, I mentioned that the ordinary folk who have these fears and concerns have been sidelined and pushed out of the group, the Linton Action Group, and their social media presence, which is a private presence. You know, you have to apply to be allowed onto that group. The leaders who've kind of infiltrated their way in and got to the top of that. Some of them are actually directors of companies which deal with kind of halfway house situations. Some of them work with charities like Cities of Sanctuary, who require as their business model that people like these migrants are housed and dealt with in their cities of sanctuary, rather than in the countryside in an RAF airbase. So that's why their slogan is, wrong plan, wrong place. And they are actually quite pro-migration themselves, because it suits their business model, it suits their ideology, and that's what they think. But this is not representing the broad cross-section of the community, and that is the problem. And Priti Patel has really, she's stirred up a hornet's nest here, and she's promised to go and visit the place herself. Hasn't happened yet. The last Home Office official who did visit Linton on News was loudly booed and shouted at as they went into the meeting in the village hall. As you can imagine, a lot of people with a lot of strong feelings. So that's the situation.
So you guys in Reclaim are keeping an eye on this. Obviously, you're there. You have a presence there as well. You said there's a documentary coming about that. When it happens, will you make sure you let me know and I'll have a gander at it. And
I will.
We can talk about it. This is something that's not going to go away. This ain't going away anytime soon. This is going to, I don't want to say it's going to snowball.
We won't let it.
But
we'll keep it bubbling and keep it in the public eye.
And I'll keep stoking the embers and poking the hornet's nest myself too, because I feel a sort of a connection to Linton on News. Don't ask me why, but I just do. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, let's look at these thugs in the European Court of Human Rights, flights to Rwanda. Why the hell isn't France doing what they should be doing to stop the people coming to before they get sent to Rwanda? So many questions, so little time with Mr. Roger Tattersall from the Reclaim Party in Yorkshire. Don't go away. We will be attempting to answer those in 2 minutes' time on TNT Radio.
Here we go again. Less than a decade to prevent catastrophic global warming. Michael Mann says so.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
What better way than to panic people by telling them they have less than 10 years in which to act on global warming? Here is ClimateGate Professor Michael Mann explaining the latest 10-year tipping point.
We have less than a decade now to bring carbon emissions down globally by 50%.
Yes, you heard that right. Despite the fact that the UN issued a climate tipping point in 1989 of 10 years, which expired in 1999, and the Green New Deal's founder, AOC, issued a 12-year tipping point just a few years ago. In fact, the earliest known climate tipping point is 1864, when Abraham Lincoln was still president. An academic warned of climatic excess unless man changed his evil ways. The more things change, the more they stay the same. For the Morano Minute, this is Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
At age 30, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, you can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Are you finding it harder to do the things you used to do? Like vacuuming or getting to appointments? If you need a bit of support at home, the Australian Government's My Aged Care is your starting point to access services. You'll find all the information and advice you need in the one place. To find out about other services, eligibility and costs, call 1800 200 422 or go to myagedcare.gov.au. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra, spoken by Heather Christie.
The radio station everyone is talking about, TNT, where the longer you listen, the more reasons you find to keep listening. Keep listening. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The radio station everyone is talking about. Well, you know what? If they're not now, my prediction is by Christmas, they sure as hell will be, because we don't mince our words and we don't beat around the bush and we don't tell people, you can't talk about that. You can't talk about that. You can talk about whatever you like, as long as you're not slandering anyone without any foundation. You can slander people if you like, as long as you can justify it. And we try not to do that here in TNT. We want to present the facts. Whew, I tell you what, I don't know what's happening here. I'm exasperated today. A lot of very emotive subjects are being brought up by different people, and they're stirring my heart. They're pulling on my heartstrings and getting me fired up. Immigration, migration, asylum seekers. Roger, when I was a kid, my old granny used to say, son, prevention is better than cure. Okay. Now, I'm going to generalize here because there are legitimate reasons for people to flee a country under threat of death or war or starvation or whatever it happens to be. And if there's a capacity to bring them in and house them and help them out and give them a start in life, I have no issue with that. Zero issue with that. Okay. But there's an old saying in Northern Ireland to say you can kick the arse out of something, all right? So in other words, it just basically means you can take something and you can manipulate it and wring it out like a sponge. There are boatloads upon boatloads upon boatloads of dinghies crossing the English Channel from France, landing at Dover or wherever it happens to be, and people piling up the beach into hotels and being brought in, dropping the mobile phones over the edge, no identification, fighting age men, very few old women, very few old men, the odd woman and child, generalizing here, but they're usually predominantly fighting age men, a la Linton O'Neill. That's what they're going to be, young men. So I'm not imagining this. Now, there are various mechanisms being put into place by the British government to deal with this when the problem hits the shore. Now, this is something I don't get my head around. Obviously I know why France are allowing this to happen, because if they're fleeing from France, then it doesn't become their problem anymore. I get that. But, you know, why has Patel not sat down and said to Macron, listen, enough of this. If they land on our shores, we're going to use the RNLI to take them right back to Calais. They're not going to be ushered up the shore. Why is this not happening? Enlighten me, please, Mr. Tattersall. Enlighten me.
Well, the issue is that the border, the kind of international maritime border between France and Britain, is right down the center of the Channel. And the center of the Channel is a pretty dangerous place to be. There's an awful lot of big ships toing and froing down that channel. And the wind can get up at short notice in places fairly shallow, so the waves can build quickly and quite high. This is extremely dangerous when you've got 30, 40 people crowded into an inflatable dinghy that could capsize, overturn, throwing everybody into the water. And we in Britain wrote the maritime law hundreds of years ago. Yeah. We called it the Admiralty Law, and you know, the first of the commandments is you don't leave people to die in the water. You know, whether they're enemy combatants, whether they're invaders, whether they're, you know, whoever it is, you don't leave them to die in the water. You have to bring them ashore and then have them go through due legal processes to decide what happens next. So this is the wicked problem, because these boats set off from France, they're kind of shepherded just over the border that runs down the center of the channel, between French waters and British waters, and then they're our problem as far as the French are concerned. Once they've shepherded them to the edge of their maritime territory, and they come over into Britain's maritime territory, they're now somebody else's problem, and Macron wipes his brow and eats another souffle. So they're then our problem, and we're not going to leave them to die in the water, because you just don't do that. And so that's why they're coming over in large numbers. I mean, that isn't the only immigration issue in this country. There's an awful lot of people who come in with visas, you know, to study, other things. The population of our country hasn't just grown by the number of people coming over the channel in dinghies. It's grown massively and very rapidly since Tony Blair kind of opened up the floodgates in 2004. And our population's grown really quickly, but the number of hospitals that we've got hasn't grown really quickly. The number of reservoirs we've got hasn't grown really quickly. Mm-hmm. The number of houses we've got hasn't grown really quickly to match this flow of humanity that's landing on us. And so this creates a big, big issue, because we're very welcoming people. We're very tolerant people. Yeah. We're very helpful people and kind people. Mm-hmm. But when things reach the point where we cannot get an appointment to see our own doctors, we're on a massive waiting list for an operation that's needed at the hospital, people understandably look at government and shake their heads and say, you're not doing your job. We voted in a plebiscite, you know, in a referendum in 2016 to take back control. That's what you told us we'd be doing, was taking back control. And it's not happening because we don't seem to be able to control our borders without European legals getting themselves involved and our own activist lawyers preventing using the human rights law that comes under the aegis of the European Court of Human Rights to prevent us dealing with this issue. That's the big problem. And I'm all ears. What have you got to say about it?
Well, again, I'm going to take everything on board. The maritime laws, we shouldn't let people die at sea. I agree 100%. But again, it reverts back to that thing, the prevention. If the people were prevented from getting into the dinghies at France and going across the halfway mark to British waters, well, then we wouldn't have to have the dealing with the potential perilous loss of life at sea. You know, it all stems back to France. And I'm not anti-France, by the way. I'm just saying that's where they're coming from. So, you know, let's have some examination. Let's examine what's happening at Calais rather than what's happening at the halfway mark. My friend, let me give you an analogy. My friend, I sometimes cut his grass. All right. Sometimes cut his grass. And I get the lawnmower spits out the cut grass, and I say, where am I going to put this? Because he lives in a flat, you know, it's like a communal garden. He says, just dump it over the fence. It's a graveyard, right? So I do, all right? Now, obviously, the residents of the graveyard aren't complaining. They're long gone. It's in the corner. It's a little pile of grass building up in the corner. But the bottom line is, I'm taking that problem. I'm going to a boundary. And I'm dumping it over, and then it becomes the graveyard keeper's problem. It's not my problem anymore. It's not my grass anymore. It seems to be, and I'm not trying to trivialize this because there's human beings involved, but in principle, that's the French approach. Let's go to the fence and let's dump, empty the grass box, and then we can go back for another mowing session, and we can repeat ad infinitum. And also, you know, you very rightly brought up the problem of infrastructure. Infrastructure has not been keeping up with the amount of people flooding into the country. And in Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland, the Taoiseach has said, we will not put a cap on the amount of people coming in from Ukraine, for example. It is a humanitarian issue. So therefore, how can we possibly sit and crunch numbers? There's lives involved. People's lives are involved here. These are human beings. It's a humanitarian. I get that. I've done a lot of humanitarian work in the past myself, on my own time, at my own expense. But there's only so much that I can do. So if a village comes to me and said, you know, there's 10,000 of us and we're starving to death, what do you want me to do about it? I'm just a dude working on my own. The same thing should apply to the British or the Irish governments to say, okay, we want to help people. Nothing wrong with that. We want to help people get back on their feet. We want to save lives. Wonderful. I'm 100% for it. But then the question is, well, where are you going to put them? And how are you going to feed them? And what's going to happen? That seems to be, well, you know, forget about that, Roger. It's a humanitarian thing.
As I alluded to earlier, you know, part of this problem is that they set off from the countries that they originate from in the first place. You know, the question is, why were those countries in turmoil? Was that anything to do with Western policies on, you know, whether they're allowed to have power infrastructure and still receive any aid? You know, these sort of questions that all get involved there. As far as France is concerned, of course, the huge problem is that we don't have sufficient leverage to persuade them to do anything about policing their coastline to prevent people setting off in dinghies, because we have various issues where the boot is on their foot. For instance, energy imports. You know, they've got a fleet of nuclear power stations that produces reliable energy. When the wind doesn't blow and the sun isn't shining and our alternative energy, sunshine and breezes approach to power generation in Britain is teetering on the edge of causing a huge blackout, we have to import energy through a cable under the channel from France and Holland. And occasionally we're putting power back the other way, but predominantly we're beholden to them for that power supply. And so that's a sort of Damocles that they have hanging over us. And so foolishly, because we haven't made sure that we have the capability to be independent, we find ourselves unable to apply the kind of diplomatic pressure at high governmental level that might bring solutions to these problems. So that's why we are where we are. And we need to go full steam ahead to make sure we can become more energy independent and can't be pushed around on that front, at least.
It all goes back to energy, doesn't it? That's what I mean. You know, it doesn't matter what we're going to talk about. You can trace it all back.
Energy is wealth. Energy is wealth. You know, we can sort out the cost of living crisis by making people more wealthy. And the way to make them more wealthy is to supply them with cheap energy that they can do business with and export stuff with and produce a good balance of payments for the country. And this isn't rocket science, you know, and government knows this, and yet they're still following this ideological route of clamping down on the use of fossil fuels, forcing us to live in reduced circumstances. Uh-huh. And it's going to cause a lot of anguish, death, you know, and anger. And there will be a backlash, and they know that.
Has to be.
But it doesn't seem to be bothering them yet.
Yet. That's the key word, is yet. I was doing a piece yesterday on Germany, and Germany closed down three nuclear power plants at the end of 2021. And as you know, they're struggling at the minute. They're very dependent on Russia for energy. And they're now stoking up their coal plants again to generate electricity. And they have three other nuclear plants that they could bring back to life, but they're still going ahead with their closure by the end of this year. So it's almost like they're committing energy suicide, almost, you know, the old tinfoil hatter would say, well, this is all by design. This is all to cause stress and the transfer of control and the transfer of wealth. Listen, there's no other way to it. I mean, it's literally like shooting yourself in the foot. Only Germany are really shooting themselves in both feet. And it's not just Germany. A lot of places, like, you know, we mentioned this at the top of the hour as well. Russia's doing bloody great out of all this. You know, the ruble tanked at the start. Then Putin played the masterstroke. He said, okay, you want to take my energy? You're sanctioning me every other way? Well, then you got to pay me in rubles. Oh, wait, we're not going to do that. Okay, then I'll switch off the gas. Oh, you can't do that. Yes, I can. You're sanctioning me left, right, and center. I can do it if I want. Pay me the way I want.
Energy is power in more than one sense, Rick. Energy is power in more than one sense.
You know, and look at the way the ruble has went.
It's nice. It's keep our homes warm. It also gives governments the power to force policies on other governments, and that is what energy is all about. And that's why you don't hear much about it at election time, because no government wants to really clue up their populations as to just what the issues are around energy.
And it can be used as a weapon because, I mean, like this whole business in New South Wales in Australia, there's 8 million residents are being asked to switch off their lights every night between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. Otherwise, the whole territory or the whole state could suffer mass blackouts. So whether or not there's an actual energy crisis at any given point, we are at the mercy of the government. They can tell us there is. I'm not saying there isn't, but they could say there is and say, okay, you guys up in Yorkshire, you got to switch off your lights between 5 p.m. and 8 p.m. and sit in the dark. Well, we're not going to do that. We'll do what we want. Okay, then, let's pull the plug on the grid. You'll result in rolling blackouts. California have been braced for them. They're going on in India. Yep. They're going on in Pakistan. They're happening in Australia. It's only a matter of time before they hit blighty shores. Like a dinghy full of people from France, we're going to see these energy blackouts and rollouts happening this year. With a minute left, would you agree with that? Are we going to see the lights turned off or flicker on and off this year before Christmas?
We face a grave situation this coming winter, Rick, you know, because that gas from Russia comes through Europe before it gets anywhere near us. We were only importing a small amount of it. We get most of what we need from Norway and from the North Sea, our own part of the North Sea. And liquid gas from a little bit from America, a little bit, quite a lot from Qatar, but the Middle East is always a powder keg ready to blow. We have energy uncertainty. We need energy security. We have to get it out from under the ground. That's the message. Get over it. Get on with it. Get cracking. Get fracking.
Wow. Get cracking, get fracking. You need to get a t-shirt with that printed on it. Maybe I'll get a t-shirt with that printed on for the next time that you come back. Roger, I could talk all day with you, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that, but my time is up, and therefore so is your time up. It's been a pleasure to see you and converse with you.
It's been great to be back, Rick. Thank you.
Anytime. We'll be in contact, hopefully in a few weeks from now. You'll grace us with your presence again. In the meantime, big thank you to Roger Tattersall. At Rog Tobluk on Twitter. Follow him on there. I'll be back after the news as a guest, I tell you, on someone else's show. So anyway, this is TNT Radio. Jeremy Nels coming up. Don't go away. He's got a fantastic first guest, which is me on TNT Radio. Bye.